All right. Thank you for quieting down. I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Faculty Senate of Wednesday, September 3rd. I have 3:01, 3:02 on my clock, so sorry for being 2 minutes late. Pat, can you please verify that we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum.
Great. So our first action item is to adopt the agenda for today's meeting. If I could have a first and then a second for adoption of the agenda. Thank you. I saw Emily and then Virginia as a second. All in favor of approving the agenda, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? All right, agenda is approved. Okay, perfect. Next up is approval of the minutes from the April 23rd, 2025 meeting. Can I have a first and a second on that? All right, I see Taylor and Felicia first, second. Any discussion on the minutes? Any additions, deletions, or corrections? Hearing none or seeing none. All in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, the minutes are approved. Pat, do we have any public comments?
No public comment today.
Awesome. So first, next up is there's a Faculty Senate President's announcements. First of all, just want to say welcome to everybody here. Welcome to the first Faculty Senate meeting of the year. I hope your classes and activities are all off to as good of a start as you had planned, or potentially better. It's been great seeing the energy on campus from our students, from our faculty and staff. It's been the only trouble was I went to go get lunch today and the line was pretty darn long over at Husky Commons, but it was good to see everybody there. I want to just thank you all for your willingness to serve on this body in shared governance and particularly on the Faculty Senate. It's really an important role, vital role to the health of our institution, and I appreciate you all being willing to serve in this capacity. Second, I want to say a particular thank you and welcome to our new faculty senators this year. I know we have a number of you that are joining and some folks who are returning for another term. So I look forward to meeting all of you who are new to the Faculty Senate and new to this body. I will be reaching out to find ways to connect with you, to get to know you and to understand your positions, what you would like to see us take on this year, just to get a chance to get to know you a little bit better other than just seeing you in the hallway on the way up. So for those new to the faculty, anyway, so that I'm not going to spend too much time during this part of the meeting talking about our external context and the various shifts in the federal landscape. There'll be opportunities to do that throughout the rest of today's session, as well as throughout the academic year and in other places. So with that, I want to focus on the work that we're going to do this year a little bit and the work that I'll be engaged in on behalf of the Faculty Senate. So Pat, if you could go to the second slide. There's a number of folks in here who have seen this slide probably way too much in the past week that I've put here. You've seen it, those who are returning, the slide essentially was the same as last year at the beginning. But I think it's important to give a little bit of orientation to shared governance or a reminder of shared governance here at NIU and broadly. So the first term is from the AAUP. I'm not going to read that, but really to me, shared governance is that idea that the healthy functioning of our university is the responsibility of all of us, of faculty, administration, staff, students, and the Board of Trustees. We all have a defined role to play and specified duties. And for the university to be well functioning and healthy, there's need for coordination, collaboration, and communication across and amongst those groups. And this is so that decisions and changes are aligned and respect the responsibilities and expertise of our various groups and stakeholders. But this doesn't mean that within each of our shared governance bodies, all the expertise resides in those positions or in those bodies. And that's where our commitment to shared leadership as an institution also comes to play. It's this recognition that expertise and experiences reside in individuals as well, and that we need to find ways to activate and leverage those. So they do interface, they do overlap, but shared leadership is not shared governance. Shared governance sometimes has shared leadership aspects, but that's not the fundamental purpose of it. All right, Pat, you can go on to the next slide. A lot of words on this slide straight from our constitution and our Faculty Senate bylaws. But really, what it comes down to, how I interpret this, these articles, is that there's several key duties for the faculty senate and its constituent bodies. They can be condensed into three general items. The first are policy decisions. So university policy decisions related to the academic core of the institution. So those are things like faculty personnel system, curriculum, and academic policies. A second purpose and function is to inform other bodies on campus of faculty's perspective, because the Faculty Senate is predominantly about the faculty's perspective, but we are a shared governance body that recognizes our staff and our students as key voices in shaping how we communicate and how we set our agendas. And finally, it's to help ensure the continued health and direction of the university by working with the other bodies on campus. And what I do want to echo is something that Provost Ellis Piper brought up yesterday in one of the meetings, where this slide and the previous slide were both shared as well, is while it says power to establish up there, I want us to think holistically about what that term power means. It's not authority and ownership. It's more of stewardship. It is ideas of leadership and of thoughtfulness in those policies. Those are important parts of having power to do something, is to do it in a thoughtful, collaborative, and in a way that's thinking about the future and the health of the organization. All right, you can go on to the next slide. This is just a real quick overview of the nested nature and what does university policy mean and all that good stuff. So for those who study higher ed, I'm sure this is way too simple. For those who don't study higher ed, perhaps it's too simple as well. But really the idea is we have a nested structure. The highest level, the broadest nesting structure is our state and federal policies. Within that, then the Board of Trustees can operate, but the Board of Trustees has to operate within that that framework or those sets of policies and rules and regulations. University policy, of which Faculty Senate is one of the authorized bodies to create university policy, has to operate within the Board of Trustees policies and bylaws and regulations. We cannot go beyond, or we cannot go across those policies. Ultimately, the Board of Trustees is the predominant body or set of policies. And then it nests on down. So what we set as university policies related to the academic and educational policies of the university, anybody below the Faculty Senate, so this is the divisions, this is the colleges, the academic units, have to operate within the bylaws that are set at the university level. Some of them come from the Faculty Senate. Some of them, a majority of them, come out of the president's office and their delegated authority from the Board of Trustees. But this is just saying, as we change university policy through this body, it has trickle-down implications. And it also means the work that you do at your local academic unit or within your college should have an eye upwards and downwards to make sure that there's alignment throughout the system. So that we're doing within a department or a school is within the confines or boundaries set by the college that are set by the university policies. And this is across all aspects of the university and the work that we do. All right, go on to the next one. So this is just too small. I'll share slides afterwards. But this is how the Faculty Senate implements its work or carries out its work. This group here is the final group for most university policies under the jurisdiction of the Faculty Senate as a whole. But that work gets carried out in a lot of the committees that many of you are a part of. You can see across the first row down, the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee, Social Justice Committee, Steering Committee, Rights and Responsibilities Committee. Each one of those are standing committees of the Faculty Senate, which execute various aspects of the duties and responsibilities of the Faculty Senate. Then you also have the academic committees and councils, which is that other group of things, the Baccalaureate Council, the Graduate Council, the Academic Planning Council, University Assessment Panel, UCL, and CAEIE, which has been paused for a couple of years. But these groups are tasked with a lot of the academic policies or academic core that's delegated to the Faculty Senate. So I just want to put this up here so you get a sense of the scope of the Faculty Senate and which bodies flow up into the Faculty Senate or get their reason for existence or their rationale or their delegated authority from the Faculty Senate. And I just want you to think, as you work in this body or in those other committees, to keep in mind those three broad areas of roles and responsibilities for the Faculty Senate. So thinking about how do we impact university policy that we have delegated power to help shape and vote upon. How do we serve as a voice in informing others on campus, other bodies on campus and individuals? And how do we ensure other groups are doing what their duties and responsibilities are, that they are being informed by our voice, by the Faculty Senate's voice? All right, so with that, we can stop sharing. And so that takes me to the ask of all of you as faculty senators. First, I just want to reiterate, welcome and thank you for the service. My hope, my expectation is that the service is more than just coming here and saying hi to me and then that's it. I'm happy to get to know you all in this kind of really hard way to get to know you. So I prefer getting to know you in other places. The work that you all have as faculty senators, you're representatives of your academic units or of the groups that have voted or selected or appointed you to this body. I'll have some materials to share afterwards that I got about what representation looks like in shared governance, maybe for you to reflect on or to look at. But a key ask I would have is to read the packets ahead of time and come prepared to engage in conversation, share your perspectives and opinions, disagree, agree, but try to come prepared to talk about the things that are on our agenda to the best of your ability. There'll be opportunities to seek the perspectives of those you represent. Again, a representative is not, you're not usually, maybe that's how you do it locally, and that's, you're all's right, but think about the group that you represent and how are you representing their perspective, their voice, their values in your seat here as a representative on Faculty Senate. Part of that is there's going to be times where I ask for information from campus. I want to learn from you all and from your academic units. So please take that seriously and give me your opinion, but also the perspectives and the opinions and values of the groups that you represent. And then I'll ask you to share it out. I do spend time after every meeting to write up a summary of this meeting with all the slide decks and references and links that I can think that are relevant. I can't tell you how many times I go across campus and people are like, I've never seen one of those. I didn't know that you were working on this at the Faculty Senate. I didn't realize the Faculty Senate changed personnel policies. And part of that is we need to continue pushing out the information. You don't have to make everybody open their eyes and read it. That's not your responsibility, but make sure it gets shared out, maybe at your department meetings or through a listserv or something like that. But as information goes out, please keep that chain of communication going. And when I ask for information to come in, or if there's something that you would like to help me learn better, bring that information forward. So kind of the two-way communication street. And as I build out these agendas and I work with the steering committee to do so, I also want you all to tell me what you want to learn more about, what conversations we should be having in this space, and ways to run these meetings better. So please don't hesitate to tap me on the shoulder, to find a time for a coffee, or drop a message, an email, or anything like that. I also have office hours if folks want to use those, but I'm also fairly available. So please do reach out. All right, that's that. I've got a few other items, just points of information, activities that we'll be taking on. This year, academic freedom has been a topic that I've been working with the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee to take on over the past 2 years, and they'll continue to do so this year. Out of those efforts and conversations with faculty and senior administration, we kind of recognize that there's an opportunity for us to have a university conversation about academic freedom in a more informal setting than something like this or the Faculty Rights Responsibilities Committee. So I've worked with Dr. Matt Streb, the president, NIU's president, President Freeman's chief of staff, and NIU's chief strategy officer, to develop a series for this semester related to academic freedom. We're going to have 3 planned sessions and we'll see what happens with that, to engage staff, students, faculty, and administration in conversations around academic freedom. The first meeting will be in September, the second in October, and the third will be likely early December. I'll share those dates as soon as we have them finalized. First one is going to be first principles and just kind of overview of what we're going to do and get to know each other. The second one will be we'll have a book study, if you will. There's a book that was purchased by the libraries, an electronic copy for access, and you can get it other ways, but it's called Academic Freedom from Professional Norm to First Amendment Right by David Rabin. And so we'll talk about that at the second one, and the third one will be kind of a debrief and a forward-looking conversation. So I'll share some information in the summary, and please, you all are invited. So too are your colleagues. So as you are available and can help share that out, that'd be great. Another activity is last year I started I had a few sessions with our newest to NIU faculty to learn from them, to build community, to understand how university and particularly shared governance can better support them in their early years at NIU, to help them stay here, to be successful here, and to share their energy and expertise with campus. And so I will be rolling those out again. Once I share that, please take it to your academic units and try to get people to participate. It's great for me to learn, but also build community with faculty on campus. I think I've only got one more thing. If anybody wants to be involved in that and help facilitate those, do please let me know. And that helps me transition to my last part of my announcements, is Faculty Senate leadership development. So I'm starting my third year in this role. I didn't say that. I didn't even introduce myself. I'm sorry. I'm Ben Creed. This is my third year in this role. I'm an associate professor in the College of Education Educational Leadership Program area. But this is my third year in this role, serving as Faculty Senate President, University Council Chair. But it's making me think about, like, how to help grow leadership in these shared governance and in faculty spaces. I'm not saying I'm done after this year. I'm not saying I'm in after this year. I don't know. But what I realize is when I took this position, Ismail and Pete were both great resources. Pat was awesome. But there wasn't a lot of transition planning. I had no clue what this role actually looked like. And what I want to do is help unpack what leadership looks like at the Faculty Senate level, at the committee level, and other spaces on campus for shared governance and for faculty to take those leadership roles. So I will be creating kind of it's still maybe three quarters baked, but an idea of helping develop the pipeline of faculty leaders within shared governance. So it's really to help me identify folks and for you to think, is this something you would like to do? Can you see yourself in some sort of leadership position? And also to understand what the heck that even means before you make an informed decision. Do I want to raise my hand to lead a committee or to even be on a committee to potentially get in the pipeline for this position? So my plan is to hold a series of informal meetings, potentially right before this or aligned with this, where folks might be available, but try to space it out so people have access to it, both in this room, but also if you know of people that you'd want to tap on their shoulder, be like, hey, you should get interested in this, you should get informed about this, to make it open to faculty on campus to learn about shared governance and leadership opportunities. So please do look for those as they come and help me identify who will lead different parts of the efforts on campus. So those are my long-winded announcements. And with that, we will move on to item 7, which is provost announcements. And I will invite up Provost Elish Piper.
Okay, it was on. Good to know, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back. Hopefully everyone had a wonderful summer and your fall semester is off to a good start. We will have our official 10-day enrollment count as of 12:01 next Tuesday. So at this point, the numbers are trending in very positive ways. So in advance of that announcement, I want to thank you for the support you've provided for student recruitment, retention, and student success. But I do have a favor to ask of you. Some of you may be working with graduate students who have not yet re-enrolled. They might be graduate students who are only enrolled in a master's thesis credit hours or dissertation credits, or they might be part of a cohort, and so they're not concerned about saving their seat in a class because they know that the rotation of courses is set out for them. So if any of you have any of those graduate students who a little reminder might help them get re-enrolled so that we can make sure that we're appropriately counting the students that we advise, the students that we mentor, and the students that we teach, that would be greatly appreciated. I also want to amplify a communication that went out, I believe, right around the start of the semester. The Disability Resource Center has moved from student affairs to academic affairs. And so the function, the staffing, the services remains the same. But we made that move because we had seen in the data that many of our students who qualify for academic accommodations, we're not taking advantage of any of the other academic supports on campus, like tutoring or writing center or supplemental instruction or academic coaching. And so our hope by bringing the Disability Resource Center into academic affairs, that we can more proactively address providing support for students and making sure that they get access to all of the resources so that hopefully they can leverage those resources to be even more successful. Also want to let you know that we are just launching our Husky First survey. This is a survey that goes out to first year students, and it basically helps us see what they need, what they want more information on, what they're struggling with, and it really helps us not only respond to individual student needs, but it also allows us to assess whether our programming and supports for first year students are working or whether there's other things that we need to be thinking about. That survey is being advertised to students. There's information around campus, but if you're teaching freshmen and you could mention that to them, that will really help increase participation. And the more data we have, the better we can support those students. That survey will be open from today through the 15th of September. Also want to let you know that next week is HSI week. There's a number of events on the calendar, including sessions learning about what servingness means and different areas of the work of being a Hispanic serving institution. But wanted to let you know that that week will be celebrated on campus next year. Much of the programming is focused at students, but we wanted to make sure that you're aware of it as well. And that basically concludes my announcements for the day. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Lori. And I think you said next year, that's next week, right? HSI week? Next week. All right. Thank you. So that brings us to items for faculty consideration. Our first one is the Higher Education R&D Survey, where we have, I think, just two guests today. Vera Little and Jeff Reynolds, if you would like to come up and give a presentation on them. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having us, and I echo the provost comments that I hope that the semester is off to a good start. We just, first of all, VP McCarsky, something came up, and so it is just Jeff and I here, but we wanted to talk with you just for a few minutes about a survey that's going to be coming out to all of the faculty and clinical faculty next week, and really to ask for your help in supporting the completion of that survey. So I'm just going to give a very brief background in what it is and why we're doing it, and then Jeff can fill in the blanks on what to expect in the survey itself. But essentially, what we're looking to do and really needing to do is to better capture what we're calling non-grant research effort that is conducted by faculty, so that we can make sure that we're fully capturing that time as part of the university's annual reporting to what you might have heard of as the Higher Ed R&D Survey or Research and Development Survey. It's an annual census that the university reports to every year. It is conducted through the National Center for Engineering and Science Statistics, part of the National Science Foundation, but it is not limited to National Science Foundation research. Again, the results every year, about 900 institutions report to it. You have to have 150,000 or more in research expenditures. Is used to inform public policy. It is used to understand where investments are going into research, what universities are investing of their own funds into research, which is a critical piece of what we want to make sure that we're fully capturing. And, you know, as an example of the public policy piece, is even being used as discussions to look at the overall level of research expenditures per institution to determine public investments in higher ed. And so that is a conversation that's being had at the state level. So again, what we need to do is make sure that we are as robustly capturing non-grant funded research and development
research scholarship artistry effort that's conducted so that we have the accurate reporting. There's just limitations within the systems, so we can't easily pull that information out, and there's a lot of nuance there. So we've been working with the NSF over the last year on what, you know, our options might be to do this reporting. We've run our methodology by them, with which Jeff will touch on, and they have said, yes, it all seems very reasonable. That's great, but the faculty do need to certify to the actual effort. So that is what brings us to the survey that we're going to be sending out, again, to all tenure track faculty and clinical faculty next week. So that's kind of the big picture. We are fully transparent in what the university reports currently to the HERD survey. There is a website on the sponsored programs webpage. If you want to go and look, you can see exactly what the university has reported over the last 5 years. Just to give you a sense, we did report fiscal year 24 at about $35 million in research expenditures. That's both sponsored expenditures, so that funding that's paid by an external grant, but also what the university spends of its own funding to support research. That split right now is about 50-50, with 50% of those expenditures coming from grants and about 50% coming from the university. We know on the university side, because we're not picking up that non-grant effort as much as we should be, we know that that's where we're under-reporting. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff.
So, afternoon. So the purpose that we're going to, the reason why we bring this survey out to you, as Dara mentioned, is because HERD wants you to certify. They want to hear from you, right? It's one thing for me to go ahead and run some simulations and or Dara's office to work up some percentages and say, we think it's going to be this by imputation. It's another thing for you to actually certify it. So that's the key important part, is what are we actually looking at? Non-grant funded research, scholarship, and artistry. It's the non-grant stuff that normally faculty, right, are interested and do. It's the advancement of the knowledge base. There's a value to that, right? And not just the knowledge base, but an expenditure dollar amount. That's what we're interested in to go ahead and report to NSF HERD. We're going to be asking, there's some excluded activities. You can see those. Basically, you know, if you write a paper and the time and effort that you have in that, we want to know, as a portion of your workload, say your workload's 100%, you do instruction, you do research, you do service, you do a lot of other things, but say that's 100%, we want to know, what is the proportion, what's the percentage of writing that paper, of writing that monograph, of that performance you might have, or that theater presentation that you might have. So it's not just the research scholarship, it's the artistry as much as is involved in that. We're asking for two fiscal years here, and a little nuance there. HERD changed the requirements, right, the expenditures. They basically expanded the measurement bounds, the upper and the lower bounds. So it's not necessary that we are purposely underreporting. We just happen to be underreporting right now. We want to catch up. That's why we're going to ask you for two fiscal years. By the way, in the survey, I will give you the dates for the fiscal years, because I get it. So most of you are on the academic year. It's like, what is a fiscal year, right? Basically, July 1st, all the way to June 30th, and that includes your academic year. So if you're on a 9-month appointment, we're interested in 2024-25, and then 2023 to 2024, and then 2024 to 2025. Again, the dates will be very specific, so you know exactly what to report. I want to emphasize too, you do not have to go to your CV, track a bunch of things down. You don't have to look back at what you did. We're just asking for an overall proportion of your effort relative to your total workload of what you have done for non-grant research and development, research, scholarship, artistry. We're going to ask tenure track faculty, as much as one addition here, as Dara mentioned, is clinical faculty. We presented to the Council of Deans 2 weeks ago, and we found that clinical faculty do have research scholarship expectations in at least two colleges. And so we're going to include that as well. Given that, right, we want to make sure that if you're a clinical faculty or an instructor for that matter, right, you don't really have a research scholarship artistry expectation, All you'll have to do is go ahead and say zero. I don't have any expectation. And I didn't necessarily have any effort with regard to that. So assistant associate full profs, we are interested in chairs and directors. They're faculty as well, obviously. The deans and associate deans, and this includes right not only the college deans, but the graduate school and the university libraries. What it excludes is instructors. We're not looking at visiting faculty, not looking at adjunct faculty. And while we very much appreciate our university administrators because they're faculty as well, their job is to be university administrators. Next slide, please, Pat. So this is an example of the assistant professor option that you have. The effort proportions, and again, for research scholarship service in a given year, and you'll want to answer this twice. So this, for example, is fiscal 24, July 1st, 2023 through June 30th, 2024. My effort proportion was 30%, 35, 40%, something like that, all the way up to 50%. What if it's 25% for a junior faculty member? You can go ahead and click it's outside the range. A little text box will come up and you can go ahead and just say, why is that? What was it and why is that the case? Thank you. That's okay. So assistant professors, the reason you have a higher proportion effort there is because we want them to be tenured, right? We want them to be successful, not only for the individual, for the department and the university as well. Associate and full professors, a little bit less. That doesn't necessarily mean that they do any less or more research, scholarship, and artistry. Every individual will be perhaps different. It'll be normed to your department and your discipline in particular. College practices come into play as well. But generally, we found chairs and directors, for example, 15 to 30%. What is their day-to-day duties? Running the department. They're also faculty, but running the department, which is why it's a little bit less than their colleagues that are professorate faculty and without a role of administration. Associate deans, much less, and deans, even 0 to 10%, right? Their job is to run the college. Cases outside the range, as we mentioned, and that faculty rank and role expectations might be different. So clinical faculty, as I mentioned, will be have a different effort proportion systematically than what you see here for, say, assistant professors or associate in full. The survey will make that very clear to you. Also, too, you can always go ahead. We're going to have an email on that as well. You can always email one of us or both will answer within the time frame. Thanks. So this is just an example of what you'll see. The survey, there's a beta version of it right now. If you want to go ahead and play around with it, it will change slightly because we've gotten a lot of input, which I very much thank for those individuals around the beta team and also the deans and associate deans that helped out. But basically, it'll be in the quality build format, hopefully very easy to look at. That's the website. Very easy to remember. You'll only have to do this once this year, but for 2 years. Thereafter, we're just going to ask you for the previous fiscal year. Can you advance, Pat? Thank you. So the time frame, September 8th through the 16th, we do, as Dara mentioned, we do have a HERD website that goes into great detail. The survey also gives quite a bit of detail. On average, we found that it takes about anywhere from 10 to 15 minutes to complete. There is some upfront reading. We have tried to make this as easy as possible for you because you have lots of other things to do. But if you take the time to go ahead and read through it, it'll be very straightforward as to where you fit in terms of the responses that we're asking you. And then once that's certified, we'll use that going forward, certainly for these two fiscal years and then next fiscal year, and report to HERD and perhaps look at a advanced Carnegie classification. Any questions?
As you come up, I just remind you, please say your name and what academic unit you represent.
Evgeny Nesterov, Department of Chemistry. I was actually confused with your example of non-research funded or non-grant funded research effort as writing a paper. I think you know that in science, most research is funded by grants and papers are written based upon grant funded research. So by definition, writing research paper is funded by grant, and we actually usually put an acknowledgement in the paper itself, pretty much acknowledging the grant which funded that research and writing the paper. So basically, for example, in my case, all my papers have been funded by grants, and using that kind of definition. So That means my non-grant-funded research effort would be exactly zero, at least using the example you gave as writing research papers, which I don't see over there as an even as an option. So what do you define as writing research paper non-grant-funded?
So noted in terms of, so natural physical sciences in particular, right? A lot of grant funding there. And yes, the advancement of the knowledge base, the reason why you're doing that research and scholarship, or for say humanities and VPA artistry, if it's grant funded, yes, the dollar amount is already captured. SPA, DARE's office has been collecting that for years, decades before DARE probably came there. What we're trying to ascertain is the value of the paper. So if let's hypothetically say you have two courses, you do some service because you're here, so you're doing service. And let's say the instructional portion of what you do and thesis and dissertation, if you're doing some of those as well, let's say that's 20%. Let's say your service right now is 10%. 70% is something else, and that something else is R&D, research and development. Between the grant portion and that non-grant portion, if you can go ahead and divide that out somehow, right? Because we can go ahead and say, yes, you have a grant. I'm going to give you a great one. You have a $3.2 million grant, right? The feds actually came through this year. So you have $3.2 million. We already have that information. We can take a look at that. But what we don't have is the basically your time and effort and working up with your colleagues, the paper, the scholar, the monograph, whatever that output is that propagates that research later on.
But that is funded by that grant, let's say. So again, it's kind of double counting if I count as both as grant funded and non-grant funded, which I think would significantly enhance the numbers, which we are not really there.
Yeah. You raise a very good question. It's not double counting because I would contend that most often we are not fully or you're not fully covering your full research effort from all of the grants, because there is, just as Jeff said, you know, work that's going into publications. There may be other, you know, data collecting that you're doing or other studies that you're doing in preparation to write a future grant proposal. Your academic year effort, which right now we don't have a lot of that academic year effort, research effort charged to grants. Most of the grant fund or grant paid effort is for summer salary. So when you think about the research that you're doing during the academic year, that is part of the regular appointment. And that is, you know, part of what we should be. And as Jeff said, that NSF is really asking that we make sure that we're capturing. That is, you know, institutional funded time as part of the regular appointment.
And Evgeny, I agree with that, but I mean, we can discuss it later.
Evgeny, just another, maybe an example to even simplify it further, maybe complicate it. The way I'm understanding it, say we don't have any teaching, we don't have any service expectations, we're just 100% research, scholarship and artistry. You get a grant, $3.2 million grant, and in it you buy out 50% of your research time. Then you have 50% of the rest of your time. Right now our systems capture that half of your full-time work that's compensated through a system that goes through SPA and we capture. It's that other 50% where maybe you're using the data you collected funded by NSF or by another institute or another grant funding source, you're using that data, you acknowledge it in the acknowledgement section saying this was collected under that, it was supported by that. But then after the grant is done, I still have the data, I still have the thoughts, and now I'm producing another paper. That is the work that is not being double counted. If we strip it down to that, I think that's what we're trying to get at, is those other times that are not fully soaked up. If you're 100% grant funded, you don't teach, you don't do service, and all of your time is 100% grant funded, then you would enter a zero and that would be accurate. But if you have an extra 10 hours a week that you're not teaching, you're not doing service, and you're not doing grant funded activities, you would put in that 10 hours as a percentage of time. And otherwise, if you feel it's 0% and you put that in there, that's what you're certifying as it, right? So I mean,
that's a great example. Yeah.
It's a heuristic example, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great example, Ben. When there are questions, certainly send them in to us. Many disciplines, right? We want to norm relative to the discipline. Usually that equates in most cases to the department as well. But as we know, we have multiple disciplines in some departments. When in doubt, look at the bylaws, look at what the expectations are, or just give a call to your associate dean in response to the grad portion of a research portion that they're responsible for. I should mention, in Ben's example, the 100% research, you might notice, ironically, we don't have research faculty listed anywhere. There are actually research faculty, as some of you know, right? Research scholars, research scientists, they're 100%. We'll take care of those. They're a small end count, so that's off the survey.
A question I have is, how will this data be used internally, if at all?
There are no plans to use the data other than for the HERD survey.
You type in your AID, it pulls up your name, you indicate your department. That's the certification for NSF. It is maintained in my area and in SPA's area. It will not be, we are not interested in tracking you, okay?
I saw George come up. I don't know if you want to say something. I have something to say, but you might say it too, George.
Well, I was just going to, real quick, George Slotsky, Department of Economics. I was just wanting to double check that you're not going to use this for anything else, but our names and everything will be attached to it and sitting around somewhere.
So your AIDs pop up on an extract data that I have.
Right.
I work up summary results. I'm in institutional research. It says decision support analysis. It's an embedded unit. The amount of data that we have that is invasive is beyond measure. It is locked down. It is secure. We have the same
standard. No, but I'm double checking. Is this something, though, that you could use in the future, even though you have no plans, but something that you could use at the future, that the individual faculty member level, you start tracking over time?
The only reason we're asking for this is NSF. The summary results is what I will report to DARE's office. Nothing else will be used.
But the data will still be there.
The data will always be somewhere, but we have standards for that at the institutional level.
Does that wipe out the individual's identification then when you go to
school? We need the individual's identification, because afterwards, a colleague of mine in my unit who has the same standards and requirements, right? We will take a look at what the reporting is, if there are systematic errors or if they're just blatant outliers, right? If I'm an econ prof, and I'm reporting 0% research scholarship, you must be differential teaching and having service. And I might just give you a call or an email and say, is this accurate, right? For one case, I probably won't do that. If 10 professorial faculty report that, that's something that's a yellow flag for me. And I'd have to go ahead and investigate that. Another example would be if I was in a position where, let's take an associate dean, 100% research scholarship. Now that's just not accurate, because we know all associate deans, they're just not going to happen that way.
I guess the only concern is about the confidentiality of tracking.
It is
time, and that's an issue that I wanted to
bring. It's secure if it's confidential. I'm the chair actually of the data management committee for the university. We have to abide by stricter standards than what you have to do for students' grades.
I know you personally, so I trust you actually at the personal level more than I do the other way, but that's another story.
Yep. Yeah, the goal is not on the individual level. Obviously, we need that for the data and the data integrity and usage. What we're interested in is what is the advantage for the university?
Just a quick question. Yeah. Is it mandatory or not? Because I think, following the previous question, I think many people will be very hesitant to self-report this kind of efforts, because indeed, as the data will be attached to a particular faculty, it may be used eventually against the faculty in evaluations and other decisions. And so I think won't find too many responses unless it's really mandatory.
So good question. We are requesting this. This is not mandatory. Some of you, I'm looking at, like, I think two or three of you will know this, and I'm dating myself here. We used to have faculty activity reporting that was required in the institution. We dropped that long ago. Some of you remember the pencils and the erasers and, you know, writing the different percentages by your chairs and departments, and then it came up to the Division of Academic Affairs. This is a request. It's going to help the university to the extent that actually it, I just had a brief conversation with the VPR today. With the funding formula of the state and, you know, Carbondale is already an R1. Okay, we have many departments and disciplines that do much more than the corresponding departments and disciplines at Carbondale. Great sibling university, but HERD changed the measurements, right? We should take advantage of that because not only does it have a better caliber, a better distinction, a better accuracy for our research, scholarship, and artistry caliber, but it also factors into the funding formula, possibly, which it's public. It's about $700 per student more. That's a good thing for the university, right? This is all upside. But yes, if someone doesn't want to report, I'm not going to make you. If an entire department doesn't report, I'm probably going to give that dean, the dean of that college a call and say, I think I'm going to have a conversation with the chair and director and please report. It's in our best interest. It really is. Anything else?
Okay. Doesn't look like it.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Dara. All right. Next up is the Baccalaureate Council, Graduate Council updates, which I will co-present with Alicia Shadman, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, and Jim Ahern, Dean of the Graduate School. So if you both want to come up, this works now.
Thank you. It's exciting to have an opportunity to talk about the coordination between Baccalaureate Council and Graduate Council today. First of all, I want to introduce myself. I'm new to NIU. I think I'm at about a month and a half right now. I started in the middle of July. And it's been a wonderful experience to join the NIU community. I'm really excited about it. The warm welcome I received from everyone has been fantastic. There's a lot of great things going on at this institution. I look forward to helping move those things forward and contribute to them. I'm also really honored to be a faculty member at NIU now. And I'm a faculty member in the Department of Anthropology, which I'm especially excited about because I'm an alumnus of the Department of Anthropology at NIU. I got my master's here in 1993, so it's pretty cool to be back in this new capacity. For the past 25 years, I've been at the University of Wyoming, and my most recent position there was Vice Provost and Dean of the Graduate School at the University of Wyoming. On the subject of the last subject that was just discussed, Wyoming just became R1 last year, and counting faculty effort was crucial to getting us to qualify for R1. So I encourage you to participate in the HERD survey, and NIU too will be in R1 soon, thanks to that. Anyway, in terms of what we'd like to discuss today, there are a few items. We're going to talk about the background of the coordination efforts, which I'm really glad that I got to walk into because a lot of work has already been done here on coordinating these two entities. We'll talk about some key policy changes that were implemented through these efforts last year, and then we'll talk a bit about some of the things that we're interested in working on this year. So, with that.
So, again, most people don't know the Faculty Senate bylaws as well as I do at this moment, but there's a line in there that talks about our responsibility to coordinate efforts between the different academic councils where there's overlap or similar policies that might be developed or similar procedures that go forward. So out of that, last academic year, Alicia Shadman, who is amongst the many hats that she wears, is also the chair of the Baccalaureate Council. Myself and at the time interim dean of the graduate school, Jessica Raymond, who's also the chair of the graduate council, began meeting with a few other individuals monthly to coordinate, to identify those places where there was similar efforts, where there ought to be similar efforts, but things were dissimilar. And just to begin that process of building collaboration, coordination, and communication across the undergraduate and graduate curriculum. As I said, there was monthly meetings that were established. We looked at those current areas of work. We have a nice Teams folder with a, you know, Excel sheet that tells us all the things of what we're working on. And we've been, as we identify opportunities to change policy, to align policy, to change procedures, align procedures, to stop doing things or to do things new, we've developed working groups. So we then tasked folks from the baccalaureate council, the graduate council, from the registrar's office and other places on campus that have the relevant expertise to come in into working groups to take on a task or a topic and make a recommendation that then flows back to typically back to the BC and GC and then up through us through their reports. So that's the structure that we've established, and we're carrying that forward with the three of us plus a few others to do that coordinating meeting to make sure things are moving harmoniously forward.
So a couple of things that we've been working on, back to bylaws, looking at our bylaws, both the duties and responsibilities of those things. Over the past, in 24-25, we worked on an online course and program policy. So that's new. It was an online course policy. We updated it to include online programs as they become more prolific. We wanted to give some more information about that. When HLC was here last year, some of you might have participated in those meetings, one of the things they noted is they couldn't find our syllabus policy. And we had one, but it was just buried under a few other policies, and when, especially when it came from the APPM. So we have now pulled that out, and it's a standalone policy there. We have not changed it. However, that's on the books to look at that syllabus policy. The only thing that's in there as a required policy statement or statement in your syllabi right now is the ADA accommodations. So that's, you'll see, but we think there's some other improvements we can make there. And then the last area was around retroactive withdrawal, reinstatement, and readmissions. That's different across the grad school as well as the undergraduate environment, but that is something that we've looked at and looking at the procedures. We've streamlined some of those procedures coming out of that policy. And then you can, oh, me, or you can click. There we go. So as I mentioned, the course syllabus policy is something that we'll be taking up in the BC and the GC. We're kind of operating as a bicameral House and Senate thing. We bring them forward as drafts from the committees. They go to the BC and GC for comment, and then we align them in various discussions and drafts to make sure that we align before we propose it and for approval at the BC, GC level. Student grade appeals, they're prolific sometimes in the undergraduate space, but probably also in the graduate space. And again, they're dealt with a little bit differently, but that is an area what we're trying to figure out. Most of the grade appeals happen at the local level. So they start with the faculty first and foremost, then they go off to the department, college, and then if that's not rectified, sometimes we get those at the provost level. But there are some opportunities there to streamline that process and also provide a standard across the university, which currently we don't have. Our last area is looking at curricular definitions. That can be everything from courses, course credits, just tightening up some of our language that we see in the policy documents. Sorry. That's it.
So that is our report. And those ones that were hyperlinked, when I share this out, they will work and take you to the new policies so you can see specifically what those policies are. Yep. All right, any questions or comments? And the last thing I'll say is on that student grade appeals updates, we did have a working group that was activated to take a look at both of those, and those recommendations would come forward. And so those will be the starting off point for this upcoming academic year's work. And there'll be more things that we coordinate on, but these were the
it's
ones.
Not everything in the Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah, that's right. It's only a quarter maybe, but. Yeah. Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
I say with trepidation, I'm going to present another item. Today is more me than usual, I hope. But this item is another one from me, and it's the National Council of Faculty Senate's updates and actions. Hopefully this is just quick. It's more informational. So I just wanted to let Faculty Senate know that I am an active participant and member of the National Council of Faculty Senate's, which is a group of shared governance leaders from across the country that have come together over the past about 6 years now. It used to exist and now it's come back together. But the idea of the NCFS is to unite the members, or it's to inform faculty senates about shared governance, academic freedom, and policies and procedures impacting higher ed. The NCFS seeks to unite our members, their members, to support and strengthen shared, effective, and influential faculty governance on American university and college campuses. So some of the stuff they do is they put on webinars on relevant topics. They share relevant and timely information. I just got a long email today with a bunch of interesting developments and some updates on what happened in Texas. I don't know if folks are aware that in Texas, they disbanded faculty governance, faculty senates in the state of Texas. Some of our colleagues are no longer presidents of their faculty senate, so we're learning how to support one another and what that means and what the next steps may be across the country related to that. And they also work to advocate for shared governance across the country. I attended the May meeting, and I thought there were some important conversations about how we define representation, about the value of representation, how to navigate the current federal and state shifts in policy and priorities. There were discussions of ways that shared governance can be used to activate, can be activated to strengthen the case for public higher education in the United States. And there was a report on academic restructuring based on mainly about academic restructuring across the country. What does it look like? What are the approaches being taken as kind of some baseline data as folks are, you know, reading the tea leaves in the world and in the country as we look at programs being sunset around the country, as we see institutions taking efforts to balance budgets and otherwise address their concerns. So I'm happy to share. I'll be planning to share these reports out with this group and with other people on campus. And finally, the NCFS passed that resolution that's in the back of your packet in pages 9 to 10. I guess it's in the middle of your packet because there's other materials. But the first part of the resolution commits NCFS to continue to work to protect the values of higher ed and the related democratic ideals, and calls on all campuses and shared governance bodies to reject accommodation and anticipatory compliance with the shifts in federal priorities and policies. The second part of the resolution is for partnership between campus administration and faculty and staff. And I would say we're fortunate that we have a strong starting point for that partnership, but this is something that we continue to build and deepen those relationships. And finally, there's a call for institutions of higher ed to explore, consider, and debate mutual academic defense compacts or something similar that is right for their context. So I'll share the resources that I've received that I think are relevant to the broader body, but if people are interested, I can put you on the listserv, I can keep you informed, we can talk about it. And if there's any questions or comments about NCFS or my role in it, please feel free now to let me know. Taylor? Man, I guess you sat on the wrong side of the room, yeah.
Taylor Atkins from History. I have a couple of comments and questions about this. First of all, as a recovering Texan, Texas gonna Texas. The other thing I noticed is that there were only 34 votes in that. This it seems to be a much smaller group than I would expect. I don't know if there were a lot of non-attendees, if it's bigger, but the other thing I noticed, though, you said there were conversations. We have one nay, we have four abstentions. I don't know if the vote is closed. I would suspect that the nay and the abstentions are probably to try to keep the heat off, in which case, if it was a secret ballot, that wouldn't be any good. But in the conversation, what were those, the five, saying? What were the arguments presented against this?
The main arguments, and it was a point of conversation, one was a representative of staff council and felt that they were not in position to make a vote on a faculty senate type of conversation. So that was one of the abstentions. Other ones were saying that there's no way that they could go back and talk to their president about any of this thing of their institution because it's a non-starter from the outset. And so they wanted a different framing of a similar resolution, but a softer one, particularly around the last point of mutual academic defense compacts. There was softening of that language all the way down to exploration is where the resolution landed, but there is places where they've already had a number of these conversations with the statements above, as well as the resolutions, that they just knew they couldn't go back. So this was not an ask that they felt that they could ask somebody else who didn't show up to take on as a charge from this national council. Sure. As far as why there's only how many ever, this was an in-person meeting. There's, I think, about 280 active members, faculty senates across the country that participate in these efforts when they're online. This was an in-person meeting in South Carolina at the end of May. And so it was a two-day affair. So a lot of institutions don't have the funding to go, don't have the time, or off contract and such like that. So that's why it's a smaller group. Yeah. The no, my assumption of the no, because it was a secret ballot, you know, it was an anonymous ballot. That's my assumption, is it was a non-starter locally or asking too much.
I see. Okay, great. Thank you.
Right. And there's no action item for this. This is just a recommendation from the National Council of Faculty Senate, or a resolution of action. All right. Next up is the consent agenda. So this is to staff key positions in committees and ensure the work of the Faculty Senate is carried out by those various committees and that Faculty Senate is represented on them. We will take a voice vote on this, on the consent agenda. We'll do a first, a second, and then a vote. So what I'll read through this quickly of what the consent agenda is, and then I'll ask for a motion. So this approves Karen Wedby to serve as vice president for a second year. It also approves Farrell Bryan to serve as a parliamentarian. I don't know how many years, but we were just talking about, that's a wealth of knowledge that, you know, we need to tap into. The Faculty Senate Steering Committee membership rosters are on there, as are the UAC Board of Trustees membership roster, confirming Brad Cripe to serve an additional, a new three-year term. It approves Wei Luo to serve on the BOT Professorship Award Selection Committee. It approves Teresa Rado to serve on the University Fee Advisory Committee, and Professor Shane Sharp to serve on the NIU Police Chief Search Committee. So with that, can I have a motion to approve the consent agenda? Thank you, Scott. Second, George. All in favor of approving the consent agenda, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, thank you. Consent agenda is approved. That takes us to our new business. The first item of new business is a proposed amendment to the Faculty Senate bylaws, Article 14. This is going to be a first reading related to the grievance procedures for violations of academic freedom. So just as a reminder for first readings, there is no formal action taken. It is simply a first reading, an opportunity for discussion and deliberation. Then we will take that into account and bring forward a second reading, assuming we get positive feedback or we can address the commentary. For a second meeting, our next Faculty Senate meeting, where we will take a first and a second and a vote on that. So with that being said, I invite up Teresa Rado, who is the past chair of the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee, and Dennis Brain, who is the current chair of the Faculty Rights and Responsibility Committee, to help us work through this first reading.
Happy Wednesday. Actually, what day is it? Not enough people know that ad anymore. Exactly, the camel. I'm showing my age. The packet has the information on this, obviously. The Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee met last year and discussed this last academic year and discussed this in some depth, and what has resulted from it was a little bit of language tweaking of changing charged to alleged, but then having a statement at the end that gives the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee the authority from through the bylaw to kind of request additional information if the recommendations from that group are not instituted, and to make their action from at that point final. This article is a protective article. It's not a punitive article. So anything here is meant to try to ensure that academic freedom is upheld, and the determination of whether it is or not comes from a faculty group. Anything either of you would like to add on that?
No, the rest would be a lot of details.
All right. So with that, we would like to open it up for any discussion, comments, questions. And again, I think we have the one mic here. So as you come up, if you do, your name and what department you're from.
Hi, Todd Reeves, Educational Technology Research and Assessment. Thank you, Dr. Creed, for putting academic freedom on the Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee's agenda 2 years ago, before this was salient, and thank you both for your work on this. Just got a couple questions about the proposed revisions and also Article 14 as it currently exists. Some of the questions pertain to the fact that Article 14 relies on a hearings process from a different article about different issues. So just as a heads up, just want to clarify that under the existing policy, Faculty Senate Personnel Committee evaluates whether there's sufficient grounds for the holding of a hearing around an academic freedom violation. And if so, it gets punted to a hearing board, a separate body, who then determines whether academic freedom was violated or not. Is that right?
I'll let you go, Ben.
Yes, it's not clear to me how that hearing board is appointed, though. I assume it's appointed from the personnel committee, and how they make that decision, who's on the hearing board.
In Article 10, there's a section called the hearing, and it's specified how that hearing board is impaneled, and it's through drawing of lots of eligible folks and then recusing and all that kind of stuff. So yes, the way you described it is FSPC would first say, yes, there's enough evidence here to go forward. Then the hearing panel would be impaneled, or committee would be impaneled.
That's a hearing board. They do that at that moment when there's an
event. That, I believe, is a lot of 20 people that's pulled. Not sure if that is that at the beginning. Yeah, I thought that was a sitting thing, and you hoped you just didn't get called.
Pat just whispered, yeah. We're doing that today. That's part of what we're doing today, is that drawing of lots.
Yeah, so if the hearing panel is ultimately the body that renders a judgment of a violation of academic freedom or not, I'm wondering if in 14.6, it should say in the second clause of the first sentence, the recommendation of the hearing panel is not followed, as opposed to it being a recommendation from Faculty Senate Personnel Committee. Although from your schematic that you put up earlier, maybe the hearing panel is a subbody of the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee. So
that's how I understand it, okay. Is that the hearing panel is impaneled based on the action of the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee. Therefore, their outcome would come back to the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee to be finalized.
Yeah,
and any recommendation from the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee would be the hearing panel's recommendation, effectively.
Effectively, yeah.
Okay. Another question I had about this is, what would happen in the circumstance where the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee is actually the body that's been alleged to have violated one's academic freedom? Because they'd be evaluating whether there's grounds to hear a grievance against them in that case. So
it's an excellent question, but I'm trying to come up with the situation where anything the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee does they do tenure and promotion things, but after it comes through the colleges and the departments, this would come from a person alleging the action.
Yeah, I'm with you. I don't know what the FSPC could, like, what sort of action. It's hard for me to imagine it. If that was the alleged violation, I don't know the recourse off the top of my head besides anything that would be in the CBA, but I think most of it defers to, I don't think there's anything that would cover this. So it'd be
a specific instance of a type of?
No, and okay. My concern there may just reflect my own naivete about what happens on that.
So I mean, I've only been on it a couple of times, but I and others who have been on FSPC, I can't think of something they do. Have you been on it?
No.
That would bring this type of an allegation.
Can you use the mic, Dennis? Can you use the mic? Sorry.
Yeah, that would be very unusual. I could imagine it maybe happening if someone had a grievance and it was turned down by the committee. Or was approved for that matter, and then someone came along in the same issue and brought it up the next year or something like that. It would just, I think it'd be so unusual that you just have to deal with those circumstances then.
Sure.
Yeah, the FSPC is primarily procedural, looking at making sure the college followed their bylaws and their procedures related to promotion and tenure. Otherwise, the stuff that they typically handle is bylaw related, recommendations towards that, or checking on procedures or policies, formulations at lower levels. There's not a lot of, you know, Todd comes in front of us and we're making a determination about Todd. It's more about policies and procedures being followed. So I can't see where it would come up, but that is a space that is not covered.
Okay. So the next, the hearing process used in Article 14 currently, which is step three of Article 10, pertains to appeal procedures for academic personnel decisions, specifically decisions about dismissal. And there's some language in step three about academic freedom, but I'm wondering if using a process from Article 10 about personnel decisions at all kind of limits in scope the types of academic freedom grievances that could be filed to ones that are just personnel decision related. And I'm thinking maybe there are teaching or curriculum related academic freedom violations that could be alleged that aren't really about personnel decisions. And I don't know
now, I have to admit, I didn't thoroughly read 10.3.2c, but it's pulled out as a separate entity. It doesn't matter that it's in Article 10 because this is just referring to it for the process. Now, if there's specific language in there, because it doesn't have to be a dismissal issue, any academic freedom item can go through that hearing process. And the way the Article 14 is written, the rest of 10 doesn't matter. It's this. But if there's language in that you're saying could cause a limitation in the 10 point.
Yeah, there's language in step three of Article 10, which is the process used right for Article 14 that talks about personnel dismissal.
But and does so it
kind
do
of
that
implies that could be an outcome of
I see. I thought freedom. You were saying it limited it to that. You're saying that could be.
I don't know. You'd have to do something very egregious for that to be the outcome. But it just seems like we're using a hearings process that's very much about a very, very consequential possible, you know, impropriety in decision making. And a lot of the, you know, academic freedom issues can probably be resolved without personnel dismissal.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So should it be spelled out then maybe in this article what the basic routine is rather than referring to another article that spells it out?
It's one solution to consider. I think another one is to go back and look through step three of the hearing, because it, as Therese was talking about, it is the should follow the procedures as outlined. So it's the procedures outlined. And the only place that I'm seeing the word dismissal within step three, the hearing, is if a majority of the hearing committee concludes that adequate cause for dismissal has not been established by the record, it will so report to the president. And so it doesn't say anything that those are the only things that can be reported to the president. That's not how I interpret it. It's the procedure for how that hearing would work. But we can take a closer look and make sure that it's not construed just to call it like academic personnel policies. It could ensuring that the language covers things related to curriculum and other spaces, I think, is a worthwhile read to see if we need to specify the procedures in Article 14 or if there's another route for it to make sure it's inclusive, because the intention, as Teresa said, this is supposed to be a protective thing for faculty to shield from, you know, like bad judgment or violations of academic freedom. So that's the intention. So if there's a gap there, then that should be rectified.
Great. Yeah. And then just one last thing. The newly proposed section 14.6 kind of assumes that any recommended redress would necessarily be implemented by administrators. And I'm wondering if there might be other forms of redress that might be directed at other areas such as curriculum committees that are comprised by faculty and really aren't kind of under the control per se of administrators.
I'm just, this is a total random answer. procedurally, I think it might have to go through the department chair, the somebody, then they might direct it to a committee to help resolve something. But I'm taking a wild guess at that if an action is asked for, I can't just go to Dennis and say, this is like, we're colleagues, great, but I can't tell him what to do. He doesn't get to tell me. Somebody else has to do that. That's not a very eloquent way of saying, I think it's got to come through that process. Am I making that up, Ben?
No, you're not. The policy as a whole talks about the redress is supposed to start locally. And if you can't find it, then it goes up a level, then it goes up a level, then it goes up a level. And so if there is non-solutions lower down, ultimately, at this point, the next level of resolution would be at the the university president, provost, and or the board of trustees to make that next decision. If you can't find a solution, you can't reconcile the decision or the violation or the action between the dean and the faculty member, or the dean and the faculty member and the chair, whoever it would be, then the next layer up would be that provost office. And that's where this process plays out, is at that university level, not at the college level. So that's why it's the provost, the president, or the board of trustees. As if a faculty member has an allegation, looks for recourse at the department level, doesn't have the satisfaction that they feel is necessary, they go to the dean. If that again doesn't work, goes up, and before any final action would be taken by a provost, by a president, or by the university on behalf of the board of trustees, that's where this comes in.
Okay. Thank you for entertaining my questions.
Thank you.
Evgeny Nesterov, sorry, I'm asking too much, but you know, the interesting questions. So following that previous talk about 14.6, newly added apparently, I'm wondering what even is the purpose of having it, considering that, let's say, Board of Trustees is a governing body superior to the Faculty Senate, so it's not responsive to Faculty Senate. So what even is the purpose of asking Faculty Senate or requesting Faculty Senate requesting explanation from a superior body, and what happens if they just ignore that request? So basically nothing will happen. So at this point, I don't see what even the purpose of having 14.6 here.
They can absolutely ignore it. However, if we have in the bylaw that this is something that is a certain level of expectation from the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee and through faculty governance, the hope is that there would be open and transparent communication, because there isn't going to always be 100% agreement on what it should be. But when A is asked for and B is done, you want to make sure people know why B. Otherwise, we just create resentment. So it's a way to have more clarity, more transparency, if the thought process on what should be done doesn't align. But no, is there a can we require it? No, that's why the language is written the way it is.
Yeah, so just to follow up on everything you just said, Therese, it's a bit performative for sure. Like there's a value in the performativity of it, I think, because it clearly states a request will go forward. If absent of a request, there's a chance that maybe somebody would be like, yeah, I don't need to respond to that. But like this allows folks to be like, look, we requested and you didn't give it, which is something there. And it's a statement of values more than anything else, because we do not have the authority to impel action from a body above us, but we can say this is what we expect, and that's the strength of what we wanted. We wanted, like the initial conversation was, we want to require this, but that is not our authority in the system. So
talk about this, whether it's toothless or not, you could, it's a redundancy, I suppose, but you could add some sort of language like it is the consensus of the Faculty Senate that this should be done or something like that. I mean, just by saying should, it already says that. But if you were on a really nail at home, you might say that that is a finding of the Faculty Senate that this is something that ought to be done or something.
Yep.
Any other questions or comments? All right, then we'll see you back here next month for first, second read, or a second reading vote and all that.
Yep. And any changes that we do make, we will highlight what those were and identify where they were made and why they were made. Thank you both. All right. Our second new business item comes, it is a motion to endorse. And so we haven't done many of these motions during my time as leadership or otherwise in Faculty Senate. So what I want to do is give a quick overview. So I will give a quick overview of the motion or of the item. We'll ask for a motion in a second, then I'll open the floor. I'll open the discussion up and then open it up to the floor. Once discussion subsided, I'll call the item to a vote and we're going to use these clickers. So if anybody did not pick up a clicker, you can use this time while I'm talking to go do so and stretch your legs. Or even if you did, pretend to go pick it up so you can stretch your legs. That's fine too. So this item is related to adding NIU's Faculty Senate as an endorsing shared governance body to the statement in support of the core mission and shared values of higher education in the United States of America, which you can find in the agenda packet on pages 15 and 16. As we take a first and a second, Pat will pull this up on the screen for us to have. It looks like she's ahead of me, so that is awesome. It's usually the case. So can I have a motion to endorse the statement in support of core mission and shared values? Thank you, Mark. Second, Karen. Thank you, Karen. So that now that we have a first and a second, I'm going to open up that the discussion of this item. So just a little bit of background before I open it up. So as folks have to know, I guess, must know, there's been a lot of activity at the national level related to higher education these past 8 months. This has come primarily in the form of executive orders, Dear Colleagues communications, changes to Asian priorities, and other efforts, which include moves to fundamentally shift how and if congressionally appropriated funds get dispersed through various federal agencies, identify allowable and viable work and areas of inquiry, and otherwise just shape the work that's going on in higher ed. So along with these actions, there have been a number of lawsuits, a number of injunctions and other activities which have stopped, paused, or otherwise clouded and shaped various aspects of higher education landscape and continue to inject uncertainty into our world, into our profession. As you likely know as well, these shifting priorities, changes in policies, executive actions, and so forth are continuing to evolve and emerge. So the work that we started to engage in the spring is not done. It's not like things have changed and now we're in a settled time. There's still activity and work to engage in, to roll up our sleeves and participate in. So NIU, through a variety of channels and at various levels, has been actively engaged in internal and external dialogue. We've collectively and individually participated in state, regional, national networks. NIU has joined in 5 legal challenges related to FNA rates and canceled funding. Faculty are involved in professional communities. They're involved in activities on campus, and they're engaged in navigating these times to remain committed to the mission, vision, and values of our institution, to ensuring our students, staff, faculty are seen, supported, and prioritized. Faculty Senate has also been engaged in that, and it remains committed to delivering on our commitments, following shared governance principles and our role and responsibilities on and to campus. In the spring, the Faculty Senate endorsed NIU's President Freeman's signature on the AACU call for constructive engagement. We work to support faculty who are concerned about the impacts of these shifting landscapes on their scholarly and artistic projects, on their students, on themselves. We held conversations with some of our newest NIU faculty to make sure that we learned what their concerns were and that they were receiving supports aligned with their needs and their hoped for aspirations. Over the summer, as I talked about, I worked with the National Council of Faculty Senates to help with that resolution statement. And so all of that work is not stopped from the university, from the faculty, from all of us as we are, as a community committed to the public good of higher education, the mission, vision, and values of this institution. And so my ask for today is that the Faculty Senate supports our formal endorsement of this statement on the screen now and in your packet. It would reaffirm to our campus and to our community our commitment to the core values and mission of the higher education as specified in this statement. It would not restrict our commitments or in any way or impel any necessary action, but it adds our voice to the more than 30 shared governance bodies that have already taken this up prior to the end of the academic year and who are beginning to take it up this academic year as faculty are coming back to campus. It will serve not just as a statement, but also provide us with some backstop or some grounding for the work ahead of us in a way to hold ourselves and campus up to these broader values and missions and be a part of our effort to have those constructive conversations that are reflected in NIU's signature on the call for constructive engagement. This is one more way to do that. So with that, I open it up for any comments, discussion, questions, or conversation. We can also have none, which is fine too. All right, I think that is wait time for this. So Pat, I know you're struggling with technology getting the screen back up. Yep. So the key points, the kind of the agreed upon framing is up top on page, where is it? Playing on my screen. 19 or 20, sorry. 20 in my version, which is not right because I marked mine up. But the first page is just some of the facts as are put in the statement. And the statement was developed by shared governance bodies, primarily out of the Big Ten to begin with. And then it has been affirmed or endorsed by those outside of the Big Ten as well. But you can see the idea of the public good nature of higher ed through teaching, research, and service. The fact that cuts to research funding have detrimental impacts on higher ed, academic scholarship and research through peer review and professional accreditation lead to evidence-based best practices and not partisan viewpoints. There's a support for academic freedom and free speech, and that those who exercise their rights to both academic freedom and free speech apply to citizens and non-citizens alike per the Constitution. We oppose the targeted harassment of faculty members of their expertise. We support First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, allowing for peaceful assembly, regardless of viewpoint or status. We agree with this idea that discrimination is reprehensible, and affirming the legal and moral obligation as educational institutions not to discriminate based on these or other identifying characteristics, and that initiatives help to reduce such discrimination when grounded in best practice. Increase opportunities, ensure real meritocracy for all. We affirm the essential role of transparent and collaborative shared governance in maintaining integrity of universities and continued strength. And finally, we call upon faculty, students, staff, alumni, and community partners at our institution to unite in support of the core mission, values, and academic freedoms of higher education in the United States. And as you can see, this was developed out of the Big Ten Academic Alliance, but it is a statement that it belongs to shared governance bodies more broadly. All right, and we're back. All right, so with no discussion from the floor, we will take votes for this, and I will turn over to Pat to walk us through this.
Okay, so everybody's had a rest from their clickers over the summer. This is just a reminder that when you use your clicker, you don't need to turn it on or off. It will automatically activate when you click the number to correspond with your vote. In a minute, I'm going to open the poll and we will ask you to click number one or A on your clicker if you want to vote yes, that you agree with the motion on the floor. You want to click two or B if you do not agree with the motion, and three or C if you want to abstain. So now I'm going to open the poll and you can go ahead and click. Once you've done that, you should see a smiley face or a check mark on your clicker to tell you that your vote was registered. If you change your mind, you can just click a different number and it will erase the first one and take the second one. You can continue to change your mind until we close the poll. Another few seconds. If you're having trouble with your clicker, just raise your hand and I'll come and see what's up. Anybody else? Okay, we'll close that poll. And that passes.
All right, thank you for the consideration and the voting. That takes us on to item 11, reports from the council boards and standing committees. Our first one up is the Faculty Advisory Council to IBHE. We have a report from Tiffany Puckett, who is our representative to FAC to the IBHE.
Good afternoon. I hope everyone had a productive summer. I don't have a real report, but I wanted to come up today since it's our first Faculty Senate meeting to introduce myself and introduce you to FAC. For those of you who are new to Faculty Senate, I am Tiffany Puckett. I'm an associate professor of law in the College of Law, and I'm NIU's FAC representative. FAC stands for Faculty Advisory Council. And so we're the Faculty Advisory Council to IBHE, to the Illinois Board of Higher Education. And that's what we do. We provide advice to the board. We write position letters. We write position papers and statements. We meet monthly, hosted by different institutions in the state of Illinois, and we discuss the issues that impact faculty and students and staff around the state. This year, those meetings will be hosted by University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, Morgan College, Lakeland College, Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and I believe Rockford University. And then we have a few spots that are still open for where we'll be attending, but I'll come back and report to you every month regarding relevant material from that meeting. You'll also have access to those minutes online after that meeting, but you'll see and hear from me each month. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. All right, next up is me again on behalf of the University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees. Our report is fairly brief. Board of Trustees met in its committees on Thursday of last week, August 28th. Those newly receiving emeritus status were recognized. We received detailed reports on the state and federal context. When those materials are posted to the Board of Trustees website, to the additional materials section, I strongly encourage you to review those slides and just see what's going on nationally in that context. They're comprehensive and outline ways NIU has been responding to the shifts, changes, and executive orders. We received information from RIPS about the efforts that they've been engaged in to support faculty, staff, and students, including the launch of Husky Frontiers and some new initiatives to support scholarly and artistic activities earlier in the pipeline. We also received updates related to active capital projects and some insights into future plans and approved work. The supplemental materials are worth the review to see to get those updates as Swen Parsons' roof is being completed, as the traffic circle on Normal at Lucinda Normal has been completed. We can see those updates and the behind the scenes stuff too that you don't see. And that covers the Board of Trustees. I don't know if there's anything else to add from that group. All right, so that takes us, no report from the Baccalaureate Council, no report from Faculty Rights and Responsibilities. Social Justice Committee, you'll see on pages 17 to 18 their report. It did not come before this body before, so I just wanted to make sure it was routed through here. There are recommendations to the future work for the Social Justice Committee and recommendations to this position to talk about how to do the work going forward for this academic year. You can see those recommendations there, and this will be part of the work that kicks off that Social Justice Committee work as they meet for the first time in the upcoming weeks. Do we have a report from SGA? Did not see Jacoby. Yeah, you do. All right, thank you.
Greetings, Nathan Gonzalez, Student Government Association. Hello, I am Nathan Gonzalez. I serve as this year's Speaker of the Senate. I will try to make sure that my report is brief. Specifically, what we student government aims to achieve for this current semester is interconnectedness, but also to promote student well-being, but as well as advocacy. We understand and recognize the current changing scope in higher education, and we are prepared and comfortable to respond, adapt, and improvise to any challenges that may come not only to us, but as well as the university as a whole. More particular, we're also focused on academics as well, in order to make sure that students' well-being and educational needs are met, but also to elevate the research prestige of this university in of itself, which is why I ask for you that if you have any sort of ideas or connections you want to begin, to get connected with us, because that's where these conversations come from, is through conversations. And both me and President Jacoby Jones, who might be a familiar face at this point, who's returning as president, will open extended arms to the rest of Faculty Senate, and we hope to work with each of you throughout this entire academic year.
Thank you, Nathan. And I look forward to engaging in conversation with you and Jacoby. I skipped over item F, the Faculty Senate UC Rules, Governance, and Election Committee. We do have a report, and this references back to the impaneling of our hearing panel. So thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Liberty, and I will be serving as the Faculty Senate liaison for the Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee this year. There is one item for your attention this afternoon, and that is the election of the 2025-2026 hearing panel. The hearing panel is used for appeals based on Faculty Senate bylaws Article 10.3 regarding due process for faculty dismissal issues and also for review of allegations regarding violation of academic freedom based on Faculty Senate bylaws Article 14. For this election, a Qualtrics ballot will be used, and Pat will email that ballot following this meeting along with directions for completing it. The ballot will contain the names of 34 tenured faculty members selected randomly, and you will be asked to vote for no more than 20. And that completes our business for Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Sorry for jumping. All right, we have no report from Operating Staff Council and no report from Supported Professional Staff Council. That brings us to informational items. A through O are our standard policy library and minutes from various bodies on campus. There's a link at P for 24-25 annual reports from various committees and bodies on campus. And item Q is our schedule for the remainder of this academic year. With that, that concludes our meeting. So I will take a motion to adjourn today's meeting. Thank you, Scott. Can I have a second? All right, give it to Lisa, but thank you. All right, all in favor of adjourning the meeting, please say aye. All right, thank you very much for first meeting.